You don't often hear about a judge being disbarred from the bench. But in Clay County, Kentucky, there was a judge named Cletus Miracle. He was one of the rare judges you will find that was permanently disbarred from the bench. Cletus Miracle was disbarred because he and seven other Kentucky officials were found guilty of voter fraud. Basically, they bought votes for candidates that were for their party or from their party. In the election years of 2002, 2004, and 2006, the group spent about $400,000 to bribe, how many voters do you think? 50, 100, 1,000? 8,000 voters they paid to vote for their candidates. And of course, Cletus was disbarred. Don't you love that name, Cletus? Only in Kentucky would you find a judge named Cletus. I wonder if you had a sheriff named Roscoe. So we would say that Judge Cletus Miracle was a bad judge, wouldn't you? And he got disbarred. In our lesson today, we find a man named Abimelech. I'm going to get my tongue tangled up on that a few times, so bear with me. He was also a bad judge. If you read all of Judges chapter 9, which basically all of it deals with him, you'll find he didn't get disbarred. He died because somebody killed him. Now, technically, Abimelech wasn't really even a judge to begin with. A biblical judge, we read about in these accounts, was one who was appointed by God to protect Israel from her enemies. But God had not appointed Abimelech to do anything. And Abimelech wasn't doing anything to protect anybody's interest except his own. All he wanted to do was gain power and prestige for himself. He was a murderer. He was a bad judge. And someone even called him the anti-judge because he was unjust, he was unfair, he was against. He did everything against the laws. So we look at the lesson, you kind of have to wonder, why do you think Abimelech wanted to seize power to begin with? Well, first of all, I think he wanted the power because he felt entitled to it. He felt he deserved it. We might even speculate and suspect that maybe he believed he was destined to be a ruler of Israel. And if you look back into some of his history, you think the person, we could speculate, and we don't know, we might think the person who put that thought into his mind was his mother. Because in Judges 8, if you look back in verses 30 through 31 of Judges 8, it says that Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. So first of all, Abimelech was not a legitimate son of Gideon, because Gideon had many wives, and this one was not his wife. And in that society of that day, we realized these concubines, these extra women that these men kept around, were second-class citizens. They weren't real wives, and the children they had weren't real sons and daughters, so to speak. The Bible does not excuse that. First of all, I want to mention it does not excuse this. It simply tells you what was happening. It's a simple recording of history. So Abimelech wasn't really the real son of Gideon. But for whatever reason, Gideon named him Abimelech, which in the Hebrew means, "My father is king." Maybe Abimelech's mother seized on that name because she wanted him to know that not only was Gideon one of the greatest judges of Israel, his father, but she wanted him to think that his father was a king. And thus, he was born to greatness. Maybe that's the thought the mother put into his mind. We don't know. But there's a problem with that notion, of course. It wasn't true. Gideon was Abimelech's father, but he had never been king. Gideon had never been king. He never was a king. He didn't want to be a king. If you look back a little further in Judges 8:22, the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian." And Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. So Gideon didn't even want to be a ruler. He didn't even want to be king. Kind of makes me think about our first president. You know, they wanted to make him a monarch. And he said that was, you know, he knew that was not the right way. They wanted to go a totally different direction. And aren't we thankful they did? So Abimelech's mother may have planted this lie in her son's mind. A lie that his father was a king when that wasn't true at all. And from that lie and from this name he had, my father is king, maybe he felt he was destined to be the king of Israel. And maybe he was willing to do whatever it took to fulfill that destiny. One of the first things he did that was wrong, he enlisted people to his cause. He was persuasive in the way he talked. In Judges 9, 1 through 3, it says, he went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and said to them and to all his mother's clan, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, which by the way is Gideon, the names interchange for some reason, they switch back and forth there. Jerubbaal, how do you say that? That looks like it was probably a pagan name that people called him. Whatever. If Gideon, all the sons of Gideon rule over you, or that one man rule over you, also remember that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, and they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our relative. So he's persuasive. He got them to follow him. Then he lined up whoever he could get. It didn't matter with their qualities. He essentially bought their allegiance. Judges 9:4 says that the citizens, they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal Berith, which is a pagan place of worship, I guess, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. We don't have anybody in politics today hiring worthless and reckless folks, do we? That's kind of what this lesson is about. I want you to kind of think about and put modern day leadership into this account here. Maybe we can learn something. But he hired these people that were worthless and reckless is what it says. He didn't care about their character. He didn't care about their leadership abilities, their qualities. He just hired them. And what's the first thing they go do? Judges 9 verse 5, to get rid of any competition he might have, he executed almost every one of his 70 brothers. Only one escaped. Immediately the people assembled and made him their unanointed king. And there is no way that God was pleased with this man being the leader of his people. And then for 3 years, if you read the whole account in Judges 9, he engaged in a lot of series of power struggles that ended up in his being killed, if you read to the end of the chapter. And that's it. That's essentially the whole account of Abimelech. And the question may come to mind is, why on earth would God put this into the Bible? Why was this included here in the inspired word? A whole chapter dedicated to this worthless man. He doesn't seem to lead anywhere. He doesn't have any descendants that we ever read of that are included in the history of Israel. He didn't have any lasting legacy so much. And it seems like we always enjoy studying things about the great judges like Gideon and Samson and Deborah. And not that these people were anywhere close to perfect. We can already see that Gideon was not a perfect man. But we can't find anything good about Abimelech. There's nothing good in this whole account, Judges 9, about Abimelech. So maybe we should have studied another judge instead this morning. He wasn't a hero. He wasn't a man of faith. He was a loser. He was corrupt, a thug, a tyrant, a murderer. And God could have easily left this out of the inspired word, and we would have never missed it. It doesn't add anything to the storyline of Judges. And yet, God gave this guy an entire chapter in Judges 9. 57 verses were completely dedicated to this evil man. Why would God do that? Well, we need to remember a verse from Romans. Romans 15, verse 4. It declares that for whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. That's why it's there. So we have to decide, what are we going to learn? What are we going to instruct ourselves about from this account of Abimelech? You know, this is from a secular standpoint, I think this is where our history teaching has kind of gone awry in our public schools. The history books a lot of times kind of whitewash and cover up a lot of things that maybe they'd be good to learn. Sometimes history is not really told that accurately. But we have to remember there's a saying that whoever wins the wars gets to write the history. And that maybe that's what's happening in our country. I think sometimes we have been too careful in our teaching to be too politically correct. And we have reinforced only politically correct lessons when we should be learning all the lessons from our country's past. So what does God want to teach us here? There's something here He's wanting to teach us. So I think there's a couple of things we can get out of this. God, first of all, wants to teach us that there are evil people out there. The Bible is very clear that there are nasty folks out there who do nasty things. You know, many of us grew up in a Disneyland kind of world where everything is sweetness and light and all of our leaders are honest and moral. But then as we grow older, we realize that there are people out there who would hurt, and those that take advantage of situations, take advantage of families. Those are the Abimelechs of our times. There have been men, of course, like him in just about every age of history, if you look at all of history. There have been power-hungry people in every generation who have hurt others because they wanted to dominate and control the world around them. They ignore morality, or say there is no standard of morality and the rule of law, to get their own way. And often when these wicked people rise to the top, we might say they are there because that is exactly what the culture deserves. And that's the sad thing. We have heard that many times before. We get the leadership we deserve. That's why I put that at the top of the slide this morning. We get the leadership we deserve. Notice that the Bible tells us just a few verses before it introduces this evil man. If you look back in Judges 8, verses 33 through 35, you can see that Gideon kind of made some mistakes here at the end of his life. No sooner had Gideon died than the Israelites began prostituting themselves to the Baals. They set up Baal Berith as their god and did not remember the Lord their God, who had rescued them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. They also failed to show kindness to the family of Zerubbabel, Gideon, for all the good things he had done for them. Look back in verse 27 of chapter 8. Gideon made a little mistake here. He made some kind of golden image. It said he made an ephod out of the gold that he collected and set it up in this city. It doesn't sound like that was a good idea, because as soon as he did that, the people abandoned Jehovah God. So the stage is kind of set here for bad leadership. The people are turning away from God. They're starting to leave. They're forgetting what Gideon had done and how God had saved them from all these people. So they're starting to turn away. As soon as they forgot Gideon, they forgot all about God. They went back to worshiping the pagan gods that they had got them in all the trouble to begin with. This Baal, which is kind of a generic word in the Hebrew for pagan gods, was particularly evil because often it required human sacrifice. And since he was also the god of fertility, there was a lot of immoral aspects to their worship in that regard. So Israel bowed before these pagan gods. They were just asking to get punished from Jehovah God, weren't they? Because of their idolatry and perversion in their worship. What we worship affects how we behave. So Abimelech and what he did was exactly the kind of leader the nation deserved at that time. Every other punishment God brought on Israel during these days of the judges involved an outside nation or a people who would come in and make their lives miserable. God would use these foreign nations to come in and punish His people. But here we have their punishment coming from the inside. And the ironic thing is, of course, they even voted for Him. They even supported Him. They followed Him. They subsidized the evil with their evil. They used money from the temple of this Baal god to pay Him and lead them. And those 70 shekels of silver that were used to pay the evil men, they were used to help kill His 70 brothers. Or 69, however you want to count it. I'm not sure what the actual count was. 70 save one, I guess we'd say. So if we want to look at it through a little bit of a political lens, I'll try to tread lightly. We just voted a few weeks back, didn't we? And we live in a great nation where we've been permitted the privilege of electing our officials. And that has been a privilege our people have enjoyed for a couple of hundred years and set the precedent worldwide for this system of government. But something has always kind of puzzled me and many others. Sometimes Christians tend to vote for some of the most wicked people throughout history. And it isn't always that the particular leader is downright immoral or wicked, but they support, these leaders support and promote policies that further the decline of morality. These leaders that we know are going to appoint judges that end up legalizing, I put in quotes, legalizing immoral activities like abortion and gay marriage from the bench. These illegitimate leaders end up selectively enforcing the law to suit their agenda and to promote their political party or promote their bank accounts. And what is amazing is some Christians have voted for these people, for thieves, for sexually immoral leaders, and they have voted for politicians who have embraced abortion, homosexuality, and all forms of impurity. They have voted for men and women who were, in effect, enemies of God. Now, I want to say, first of all, to add in here, that I realize there will never be a perfect candidate for our leadership, will there? You can even look at Gideon, like I've pointed out. Gideon was not perfect. He had a lot of flaws. He made a mistake there at the end of his life, erecting this golden image, whatever it was. But he was still head and shoulders above the others in his generation. He was dedicated to God and His cause. He was faithful to God. We need to always select leaders that are head and shoulders above their peers when it comes to their dedication to morality and to God. Not that they're going to be perfect, not that they're never going to make mistakes, but they need to be like Gideon, and they need to be dedicated to God and Him alone. We can't sit idle waiting for perfection because perfection will never come. That's something that personally that bothers me a lot about a certain segment of our political society, if you would call them that. This certain small segment is very outspoken. They stir up strife. They meddle in politics without actually getting involved. They write articles in the paper. They write blogs on the internet that stir up. I'm talking about our libertarian neighbors. They grouse and complain about how everything is going wrong, our leaders are illegitimate, and yet they won't lift a finger to change the direction of the country. They just sit at home in their basements, writing on the internet and writing editorials in the paper. Political soapbox is over now. The Christian has the responsibility to not only respect our leaders, and since we have the opportunity to have a voice, we need to use that voice, is what I'm getting to. I would say it is good to support good candidates, so we should do it. James said, if a person knows to do good and doesn't do it, it's sin. It's good to support good leadership in whatever way we can. Christians should never blindly support leaders that are immoral, just because they are of the party that they have always supported. We are a holy people. We have been bought with a price. And for any believer in Christ to go to a ballot box and leave God outside is an abomination, is a shortfall, is a greater sin, I think. If you're not voting for the principles of God, you might as well be voting and supporting Abimelech, because that's who you'll ultimately end up with. A nation gets the leaders it deserves. And a nation who leaves God out of politics will end up on the wrong side of God's wrath. William Penn put it very succinctly and very accurately when he said, "If we are not willing to be governed by God, we shall be ruled by tyrants." So you have some people that say, "Well, let's just vote all the bums out. Let's just vote them all out. And that'll fix the problem." Well, first of all, if you vote all the bums out, you end up with more bums, because there's always going to be bums in politics. Does anybody say bums anymore? That's not really, that's kind of old, isn't it? We don't say that anymore. It's probably not politically correct. Maybe they're there because God wants to get our attention. I don't know. Because often if God's angry, He's giving us what we deserve. We can vote out all the bums we want, but the problem will still exist, because the real problem is our nation's endorsement of immorality. Maybe that's the previous slide. I think I'm getting ahead of myself here. Yes. The problem is our nation's endorsement of immorality. Immorality at the neighborhood level. And the real problem is we keep voting for politicians that embrace that immorality. We don't want leaders, I'm speaking in the generic term, our neighborhoods, people, society, doesn't want leaders that tell us certain lifestyles are wrong, because they are engaged in the lifestyles that they know are to be wrong or don't want to hear are wrong. So then what's the solution? If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14. So we can't fix our problems entirely from the ballot box. We're thankful we have the opportunity. We need to do the best we can there. But politics will always be a nasty business. And politicians will always make decisions that might break our hearts and even turn our stomachs. But our hope is in God. Our hope is at the edge of the beds when we pray. Wherever there is power to be had, people who will want that power will rise to the top. It doesn't matter if it's in politics. It doesn't matter if it's in a business. It doesn't matter if it's in the home or a marriage or in the church. There will always be people who seek to dominate and control. The thirst for power is the strangest thing. It makes people behave in some bizarre ways. I found this illustration, and I don't know how accurate it is, but somebody recorded it, wrote it in a book, that in June of 1974, Richard Nixon had planned a trip to Russia and Italy. His two top aides, Alexander Haig and Ron Ziegler, both were struggling for power in this administration. They wanted to be the top. Their rivalry got so intense that each of them had their own team, of course. That's how it works. You appoint somebody to be your aide. Well, then they get to appoint lots of people to be their aide. And they get to, anyway, it goes on and on. Pretty soon you have 500 aides for one aide. His team actually measured down to the inch of how far their beds were from Richard Nixon's. They wanted to have the room that was closest to their leader. They wanted to be number one. Does that sound normal? Does that sound sane? Of course not. That sounds like children, doesn't it? Fighting over the slice of a pie. It's about as bizarre and petty as it gets. Yet folks who are into power and want power will do stuff that normal folks wouldn't even consider. That's the kind of thing we expect from pagans, isn't it? They don't love God. They don't have God in charge of their lives. And so if God is not in charge of my life, who is? I am. If God is not in charge of my life, then I am in charge, and I can do what I need to do to get to the top. It's the most logical thing in the world for folks who are pagans to seek to be the God of their own lives. God in the small g. Somebody has to be in charge, so it might as well be them. And so they would do the most... Pagans would be the most likely to seek and manipulate and dominate and rule over others. That's what you expect. And that would never happen in the church, would it? Well, it could. It can. We are warned about this. Consider the words from Paul to the church in Galatia. They were having power struggles there, if you read into the history there. And we're going to read from Galatians 5, 19 through 21. We're going to leave out some of the words that are not really relevant to what the point we're making here. It says, "Now the works of the flesh are evident." It mentions enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, and envy. These are the behaviors of those who seek to control, manipulate, and dominate. But just in case you might be tempted to think that Paul was just making a list, and so if you're not on the list, you're okay, and you're in the clear, he adds at the very end, Galatians 5:21, "But I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God." And he mentions another situation, he mentions a lot of these things, and things such as these. He warned the Galatians about this because they were doing just that. They were engaged in these works of the flesh. They were backbiting, they were into rivalries and dissensions and divisions, and it was endangering their very salvation. Jesus warned about this as well. Jesus called his disciples together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must make everyone his servant." Everyone who wants to be great among you must be your servant. There we go. "And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Matthew 20, 25 through 28. If we want to be great among our brethren, we need to be their servant. Whoever wants to be first must become a slave. Because Jesus didn't put himself in first place, did he? What did he do at the Last Supper? He took the lowest job in that household and washed the feet of his apostles, his disciples. So I think the lesson we can learn from Judges 9, another one we can learn, the spirit of Abimelech can happen anywhere. It happens in politics. It happens in the business world, in marriages, and even can happen in the church. Wherever there is power to be struggled over, people struggle to gain that power for themselves. They do this because they believe that power is important. And they even have a proverb they use to justify their mindset. They believe that God helps those who help themselves. I challenge you to find that in the scriptures, by the way. God helps those that help themselves. That's your homework for this afternoon. Go get your concordance and find that out. Because I can tell you it's not there. It's a pagan proverb. It came from the Greek faith. The Greek myths and things. It was in somewhere in Greek literature. And so our society has taken it and used it to justify their actions. God doesn't help those who help themselves. God helps those who listen to Him and obey Him and trust Him. Jesus said, "You want to be great in this world, you need to learn to be the best servant you can be. And the only way you can do that is if you learn to trust God. You cannot be a good servant if you don't believe God will have your back," as we say today. If you don't believe God will be there for you, you always believe you need to control the life around you to protect yourself. If you don't believe God is working in your life to give you the things you need, and only what you need, then you're going to try to put yourself in control of every situation to control and protect yourself. Those that don't trust God feel a strong need to control everything around them to suit their needs and wants. Jesus said, if you want to be great, you need to be a servant. That's what made Gideon such a good judge. He didn't want power, did he? He rejected it. He wanted to be a good servant of Israel. He wanted his nation to serve his Lord. Think back to what he said when Israel offered him the throne. I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. He knew that's not what Israel needed at that time. He had learned to trust God. And because he trusted God, he learned to give him the glory. Because Gideon gave God the glory, he became one of the great heroes of the Old Testament we read today. The glory belongs to God, and therefore the power belongs to God. The struggle for power, it always boils down to who gets the glory. If I want the glory, then I'm going to want the power. That's the basic lesson. But God said, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another. If you read the American Standard Version, it says, I am Jehovah, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another. Glory belongs to God, and He is not sharing it. Someone wrote a poem about this. Now, there may be a Christian song, worship song, with these words. I don't recognize it, but I think it was attributed to a song. Somebody wrote this poem. Have you been called to serve where others failed and or tried and failed? But with God's help and strength, your efforts have prevailed. Touch not the glory. Has God appointed you to some great noble cause, or put you where you hear the sound of men's applause? Touch not the glory. Have you some special gift, some riches you can share, or have you learned the art of intercessory prayer? Touch not the glory. A watching world still waits to see what can be done through one who touches not that which is God's alone. Touch not the glory. Only when we learn that the power and glory and honor belong solely and only to God will we enjoy the blessings that come from being His children. But you can't truly know those blessings until you belong to Him. So I'm going to ask you this morning to belong to Him. Belong to God. And the things that you do in your life, don't do it for your own glory, but do it for God. Don't be like Abimelech and seek out power, seek out control when you need to let God take control of your life. If you would, let's stand and sing this morning.